This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 236.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we empower you to become a lifelong runner. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with Jonathan Beverly, author of the new book, Run Strong, Stay Hungry, 9 Keys to Staying in the Race. And in the quick tip segment, we answer a listener question about how to deal with being a slower runner. And remember, you can get all of our back episodes and training plans and more with a membership to the Academy. Just visit marathontrainingacademy.com for details. Okay, Angie, so we are eagerly awaiting our new treadmill.
Yes, it's supposed to be here on Friday.
That's right. You ordered it through Amazon, didn't you?
I did.
So does Amazon free shipping?
Free shipping, and they bring it inside our residence, supposedly.
So I don't have to hurt my back trying to get it down to the basement.
Well, I don't think they necessarily bring it to the final destination.
Okay.
We'll have to wait till our muscular son is home from school to carry it down.
You guys might remember on the last episode I talked about how I was being an idiot and hurt my back trying to move a refrigerator into the house. It's getting better, though, and with a little break in the weather, I've been enjoying getting outside and running and living life to its fullest, Angie.
Sounds like it's time to hurt it again.
In fact, I kicked off the new year by running in the snow, and when I got back inside, I signed up for the Pittsburgh Marathon.
Awesome.
Here in Pennsylvania, which is going to be in May. So excited to have a race on the calendar. And you don't have any new races on the calendar, do you?
Nope, just Grandma's in June.
Okay. Well, if that changes, we'll let you guys know.
That's right. You guys will be the first to know.
Before Angie tells her mom, she will tell you guys.
Right.
Okay, so what else is going on? We've got, at the time of this recording, the Disney Marathon, Disney World Marathon, Dopey Challenge, Goofy Challenge, all that good stuff just wrapped up. And we had quite a few members who completed it this year and some coaching clients. So you might have a few shout-outs from those folks and from others.
That's right. This first note comes from Mike in the Academy. He says, the Dopey Challenge is done. It was quite the experience. My 5K was a personal best. My 10K was a personal best, where I finished 38th out of 607 in my age group. The half marathon, I made myself slow down and still ran a very solid 2:06:24. The marathon started out good, but by the 21.1-kilometer timing mat, my quads were on fire from the half, plus I had blisters on toes on both feet. But I finished solidly in a time of 5:05, which put me in the top 25% of all finishers. From 2 years ago until now, it's been so much fun and such a learning experience.
Well, congrats, Mike, on toughing it out. And man, just all the photos I've seen from these folks, it just looks like they're having so much fun. I've, in spite of the blisters. I think I want to go down there and do this thing next year or the year after.
Wow. Better decide soon. It usually sells out.
I know. For folks that haven't heard of it yet, the Dopey Challenge, you do a 5K one day, 10K the next, half marathon the next, and then a full marathon on the fourth day, and you collect bling from all those races, plus another couple pieces of bling for completing all those back-to-back races.
And a bunch of shirts and, you know, lots of Disney goodness. Yeah, we'd like to say congratulations to Richard in the Academy, who also completed the Dopey Challenge. Julie also did Dopey. She says, Dopey complete. Fun, challenging, yet I'll never do it again. Ha ha. My poor feet. Thank you, Coach Jennifer, for getting me to the finish line strong. My last miles were my strongest all weekend. I need to sleep for a few days to fully process what I just did.
That's awesome.
And I think one of the challenges of Dopey is that you have to get up super, super early, like for 4 mornings in a row.
That would be the hardest part.
And it was pretty cold, you know, for Florida. So people talked about being up and shivering early in the cold. So
just take lots of good throwaway clothes.
That's right.
For every day. Note to self.
Your whole wardrobe thrown away. And we'd like to say congratulations to Amy in the Academy. She says, first marathon in the books at the Disney Marathon. Thank you, MTA, for inspiring me on this journey. Even though I hurt right now, my body will recover and I'll be doing it again soon.
Everyone's hurting, it sounds like. Well, congrats, Amy, on finishing your first marathon. You chose a magical place. I'm sure that Disney folks would approve of me saying that.
Right? That's right.
We need Disney World to sponsor this podcast.
That would be nice.
So if any Disney execs are listening, hint, hint. We'll take free race entries next year. Right, Angie?
We'll take cash. We'd also like to say congratulations to Academy member Zach. He says, congrats to everyone that finished Disney today. My legs tanked in the cold and cramped at mile 18, but I waddled my way to the finish line. Thank you, Angie and Trevor, for getting me to my first marathon, and everyone else for being such a supportive and helpful community. Turns out I do have what it takes. Now time for some roller coasters. And Zach finished in 4 hours and 14 minutes.
That's a pretty fast-paced waddle.
I know. I need to get that waddle on.
Great job, Zach, on your first marathon.
And congrats to Suzanne, who got an 11-minute PR at the Disney Marathon. She credits MTA and UCAN for giving her a strong race. And also congrats to NJ, who says, I was at Disney too and PR'd as well, mostly due to Angie's UCAN strategy and the Run, Walk, Run pace group I was with.
Nice.
So lots of great strategies going on there. Congrats to Gregory from the Academy. He says, Disney Marathon in the books, new PR thanks to the great coaching of MTA.
Right on.
And finally, Cher in the Academy says, I shaved almost 40 minutes off my marathon at Dopey this weekend. Big thank you to Coach Lynn and MTA for connecting me with her. I've been training with her for almost a year and have enjoyed PR after PR in 2017. So many I've lost track.
Nice.
I trained with a non-MTA coach for over 2 years with no PRs, not even one. Great guy, but his plans had me running too much and I started getting injured. I'm so happy I took the leap and joined MTA.
Wow, that is like one of the best testimonials. And she works with Coach Lynn Grieger, who's a fantastic coach of ours on the team, has very happy clients. Congrats, Cher, on the massive 40-minute PR, completing the doping challenge, which is not easy. And man, Angie, I think I missed out. It seems like everyone was there.
Everyone who was someone was at Disney this year.
Well, congratulations to all of you who are getting a strong, successful start to the new year, 2018. This is our first 2018 episode, and we're excited about our guest, Jonathan Beverly. He is the former editor-in-chief of Running Times magazine, which was owned by Runner's World, and he's also a shoe editor for Runner's World. He lives in western Nebraska, close to the Colorado border with his wife and son. And we previously had him on the podcast in 2017 to talk about his then-recent book, Your Best Stride, which is all about running form, and that was an extremely popular episode because it was just so practical, and there were a lot of just nuts and bolts tips on how one can improve their running form. So it was like one of our most popular shows in 2017.
Yeah, we actually got a couple of notes from listeners who mentioned Jonathan Beverly and listening to the episode. Adolfo said, I wanted to tell you guys that I ran the New York City Marathon. At the expo, I met Jonathan Beverly, who I heard on your podcast. I had a great conversation with him about posture and bought his book on the spot. Adolfo was able to finish the marathon strong. He says, thank you for all your podcasting efforts. They're an important part of my marathon training.
Well, glad we can be there for you, Adolfo. Appreciate that.
That's right. And Ben says, being a young single adult in a city, it can be hard to go to bed early as there are so many things to do. But it was your podcast that kept me moving during the mornings that I wanted to stay in bed. One of the most memorable podcasts for me was when Jonathan Beverly was on your episode. I learned a lot from it, and that was just before I learned that I was moving back to Iowa to be with my mom as she took on her challenge against breast cancer. I'm proud to say I completed my first marathon with a time of 3 hours 40 minutes at the Twin Cities Marathon this fall, and I recently was selected for the Chicago Marathon in 2018, and very excited to run in the city that I live in.
Well, that's great. Yes. Thank you for that comment, Ben, and congrats on running your first marathon in such a fast time and getting in Chicago. Glad the episode with Jonathan was helpful. I think you're going to enjoy this one too. I think everyone's going to enjoy this one because it's all about how to be in this thing for the long haul. That is, how to become a lifelong runner. And the way the book works, by the way, the book is called Run Strong, Stay Hungry. But the way it works is he went out and he interviewed lots of masters runners. Some of them are well known, like Joan Benoit Samuelson. Some of them not so well known. But people who've been running for like 40 years or more. So Jonathan went and did these interviews with these folks and kind of distilled down what he learned. And there are 9 keys that we're going to have him walk us through. Angie, what did you think of the book?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. Very helpful to see how people are able to keep their passion for the sport of running and also, you know, keep their body healthy and be a strong runner for life, which is my goal, and I know a lot of people's goals who are listening. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it was great.
So in this conversation, you're going to hear why some runners gave up the sport while others have continued running for decades. And just to note that we did record this before Christmas in 2017, but we decided that we would release this interview as our first interview in 2018 because it's a great first of the year kind of episode. So that's what's going on there. Let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Jonathan Beverly, author of the book Run Strong, Stay Hungry.
Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
Okay, we're on the podcast now with Jonathan Beverly, author of the new book, Run Strong, Stay Hungry. Jonathan, great to have you back on the MTA podcast.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you for hosting me again.
The last interview that we did about your running form book, that was one of our most popular episodes of 2017.
Yeah, we're still hearing back from people about how helpful that was.
So the bar is set high, man.
All right. Well, glad to hear it.
So in this book, you really seek to answer why some runners burn out and leave the sport of running behind, while others continue to run, you know, with passion decades later. So did the process of asking these questions come from your personal experience becoming a master's runner and starting to compare your present self with your past self, or how did it come about?
Yeah, that's pretty much, I think, how I started being interested in this topic. I mean, I got old myself and got to the point, I mean, as I talked about in the intro, I mean, probably about mid-40s, I really thought, you know, that just hang it up. Yeah, I'll still be a runner, but I won't compete anymore. And it didn't last very long because I found that I missed it and I wanted to compete. And then I had a number of friends that seemed to, you know, continue, you know, for decades. And even though they weren't competing at the same level they were before, they seemed to appreciate it as much or even more. So started talking to them and eventually decided I wanted to talk to as many as I could and figure out what's common about them.
Can you give us an idea of some of the people that you talked to for this book?
Yeah, well, probably the most famous would be Joan Benoit Samuelson, first Olympic gold medalist, marathon medalist.
Who's still going strong.
That's right.
She is. Yeah. She was going to run Chicago this year. She was aiming for a sub-3 at 60, but wow. Actually she got hurt and didn't do it. And she did text me after that and said, this story's still to be told. So she's still looking for the sub-3. And I've had the fortune of knowing her or knowing about her. We both grew up in Maine, and I was in high school when she was in college. So we're on the same course together. And then I've been able to go back and interview her a few times. So I was really fortunate to be able to talk to her. She's a little bit of a recluse, but we met, let's see, it was about a year ago right now, in a coffee shop in Freeport, Maine, where she's from, a snowy night, and I spent over an hour together. And,
nice.
and then she called me back a few more times. So anyway, she's most famous, but then, yeah, Dina Castor, Colleen Deruck, Bill Rogers, Benji Durden, all these names, you know, and then a number of names that you wouldn't know, but are impressive runners. A guy named John Murth. He says he's won a race every year since high school. So like 1975 till now, he's won at least one race a year. And,
nice.
And had like a 2:27 marathon best, but you know, impressive through the decades. A guy named Dan Grimes made 3 Olympic trials, ran on the U.S. team in a world championship. Never heard of him, but here he is in his 50s, 60s, still loving it, still pushing it. So a lot of people like that. And then some more like me, you know, like I was a 2:46 best marathoner. It took me a lot of years to get to there. But I've been running for 40 years now, since I was 13 years old, and now I'm 53 and running and racing all that time.
That's really neat. Yeah, you were able to, I guess, over 50 masters runners that you got to interview and kind of glean some wisdom from them. So what are some of the reasons why other runners gave up the sport as they got older? What are some things that you found?
I did start with, actually, I put a query on Facebook and I talked to some people I knew, but said, you know, if you used to be a runner and aren't anymore, you used to be a competitor, contact me. And I heard a lot of stories, interesting stories. Like the most famous there is probably like Joe LeMay, who was also, I don't know if he was an Olympian, but I mean that level, top level athlete.
What's the name?
Joe LeMay.
Joe LeMay. Okay.
Yeah. And he decided couldn't give anymore. So some of the reasons, mostly for the really top athletes, it seems that they have a harder time perhaps than the rest of us because they actually are winning races. It's absolute. Yeah, one guy, I'm blanking on his name right now, but anyway, ran an Olympic trials, 10,000, didn't make the team, Gary Robeson, and threw his spikes in the trash and hasn't run. He doesn't run hardly at all anymore. So there's that, and then there's people that get injured, obviously, and then people who I think their lives change and things get in the way. Schedules change, and things just get in the way, and pretty soon it's something they used to be a runner and they're not anymore.
Yeah, we actually interviewed Ryan Hall recently, and that was one key of him retiring from professional racing and becoming more of a recreational runner now, is that he just felt like being a professional runner just kind of ate him and spit him out again.
His body.
So
now he's been able to put some weight on and focus on other types of exercise, weight training, and just run recreationally and really find the joy in it again, sounds like.
And it's kind of, it's hard for me as a runner to relate to people who are winning races and are competing, like qualifying for the Olympic trials or consistently placing in their age division. I kind of came to the sport a bit later, my late 20s, and my training's been interrupted by pregnancies and things like that, but I still find like I'm very dedicated to running and want to be a runner for life. And so even for me, who is not like super competitive, I really thought these 9 keys that you brought out in the book were really helpful for having a long-term picture of what running can look like and, how I can be a strong and healthy runner for life. So I thought, maybe we could dive into each of these a little bit and you could, really drop some wisdom on our listeners from the book. The first thing you talk about is consistency. So break that down for us. What does that mean?
Yeah, and this was kind of, it stood out pretty quickly. People talked about, when they've been runners for 40 years, they have been a runner for 40 years, most of them. They didn't take a break any time. But one key is consistency, but not constancy. The consistency doesn't mean streakers. There were a few that were streakers that ran every day, but most of them said, totally against that. You need a day off. You need seasons. You need up times and down times but you have to stay fit enough. And that's what I saw from them, is that a lot of them have been running, 50, 60 miles a week, almost consistently, consistently for all these years. And we think sort of you're going to burn out. It's going to be too much. I correlated that with some research, new research coming out, Australia primarily, that talks about that when we talk about overtraining issues, that's really sort of a misnomer. That's not the volume that hurts us. It's ramping up to the volume. It's the increase. And so the consistency makes these people strong and strong enough to handle what they want to do. So that's the key, is that you're staying fit enough that you're not doing this up and down all the time. And that's where you're more likely to get injured. Is ramping up is where you get injured. It's not doing the volume. It's increasing the volume, increasing the stress on your body.
So it's actually easier for your body if you maintain year-round fitness than it is to have to, go to zero and then ramp up again. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. One quote I thought from Scott Douglas, he's former editor of Running Times and one of the guys, again, I've interviewed that's been going 40, 45 years. He says it's easier to run 50 miles a week than it is to run 20 miles a week, which sounds, but you're strong enough then it's a habit and you're doing it. You're just rolling with it, as opposed to, 20 miles a week, you're probably only running 3 or 4 times and it's not as habitual and your body's not as tough. It's not as strong.
Yeah, good point.
I know personally from, marathon training, it's easier to stay in marathon shape than it is to get out and then have to get back in. So, looks like a different thing for everybody, depending on the kind of distance they do and, how competitive they are. But yeah, I think that's very true. So, consistency is one big thing. You talk about variety then, kind of talk about mixing things up. And is that like your type of workouts or having like seasons in your training? Talk a little bit about that.
So I'd say yes to those. This is where I think people sometimes run into trouble, is that I think consistency is that you do the same thing every day. In fact, I started the chapter with the weekend warrior sort of asked you, so how much do you run? 6 miles a day? And it's like, well, no. Sometimes I do 10, sometimes I do 2.
Right.
And so, and consistently good runners have variety in their training. Hard days and easy days, fast pace and slow pace, different terrains, different seasons, all of these things to both maintain interest and to maintain the strengths in your body, that your body needs variety to keep healthy and to be as fit as possible. You need to work all the systems. And so sometimes you need to be doing fast strides or quick hills. Sometimes you need to be doing tempo work. Every day should be somewhat different, different stresses on your body, working different systems and having fun.
Did you find that a lot of these runners also do a variety of distances when it comes to racing or different kinds of races? Like there's maybe some of them were also triathletes or...
I did find that most of them enjoyed a variety of racing as well. It's helpful, yeah, prefacing some further points in terms of being adapting and adapting your goals. It's helpful to have multiple venues that you race in. So there's different challenges there. I did find, though, that as people get older, you can't do everything and you tend to specialize a little more. But I think it's good, especially when you're younger, to try multiple things, again, to be able to get both the interest and the variety of stresses on your body and the variety of goals that shows you.
Do you think for a master's runner in the variety category, you know, those ancillary exercises to keep the body strong, you know, core training, strength work, maybe, you know, stretching or balance work, do you see that becomes more important for most people?
Yeah, I did. And people typically said, it's like me, I didn't take them that seriously younger. I mean, there's a lot of people, and a few people have been able to get away with that. They're like, I don't stretch. I'd rather be running. I don't do anything else. Yeah, that's just time I should be running. But the majority of people found that in their 40s, in their 50s, that you just had to spend more time with the ancillary work. It's the flexibility work, the drills, the strength training. We talked last time on the Stride book. I mean, a lot of that I continue to apply even more and more. Yeah, doing my squats in the morning when I'm grinding my coffee, doing hip flexibility stretches while I'm sitting at my computer. And several people said now they're getting to the point where they spend more time on the ancillary work than they do running, which is kind of hard to handle, but it's necessary, you know, maintenance mode. Mike Finelli says, you know, that all of it's in maintenance mode now. It's, can you keep the systems going? That's an important thing.
And I guess there's probably a difference between your running fitness and then having overall fitness. You know, as a person gets older, obviously, it's kind of like you don't use it, you lose it. So a lot of that muscular strength becomes even more important and stuff like that.
Yeah. And we just spend too much time sitting and being sedentary the rest of our lives.
Yeah. So the third key to staying hungry is training by feel. What does that mean?
This was a huge one, and perhaps it's the core of this book. Everything, I think, sort of rotates back to this. Mm. And it was probably maybe the biggest surprise. I expected to find people, you know, having detailed training programs and having, you know, the logs, and I did find some of that, but, you know, that they would be able to tell me what they did, you know, to prepare for their 209 marathon in 1980 and what they did to win the Masters Championship. You know, nobody wanted to talk about that pretty much. What most of them said was the key is to learning to pay attention to your body, learning to adapt and say, on this day, my body needs to do this. Joan Benoit Samuelson is probably one of the best. She says, I've always run by the seat of my pants. I've always decided what I'm going to do, even when she had a coach. The coach was mainly just to, you know, give a little bit of direction and motivate her. But she decides now what she wanted to do was to run long and run hard and to push it. And you have to have the consistency and you have to have the variety, all these things. But I thought Gary Allen, the guy from Maine who's run, he's a character, by the way.
He's an RD too, isn't he?
Yeah,
he is.
Mount Desert,
yes.
Island and Millinocket.
And you just did that marathon this year,
mm-hmm.
2017.
You did the Mount Desert Island?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that was a beautiful race.
Yeah, that's near where I grew up, right, that area.
Wow, awesome. Nice.
But yeah, he did Millinocket. I went up there last year, and that's where I interviewed him. He's run sub-3-hour marathons over 5 decades, and he's one of these really, really consistent guys. But he said that, you know, after experimenting and following, you know, trying to do 140 miles a week, and he became a chef. That's what he says. You need to learn to become a chef. And I love that analogy as far as saying when you're learning, yeah, you need to follow the recipe. You need exactly a cup of flour and a teaspoon of salt. But a chef learns what all the ingredients will do and then starts combining them. And that's the training by feel analogy that you go out and he and a number of other guys, Steve Cartaglia says, I often don't know what I'm going to do till a couple miles in. And you go out and you start running and you're tasting the soup. Okay. So what does it feel like? It feels, I feel pretty recovered, but I could use a little bit of sharpness. So let's charge up the hill a few times here. And that becomes your workout. So it solves a whole lot of problems. One is the question, again, of sort of how do you adapt to, you know, what you used to do rather than going out. If I tried to do the workout I did when I was 35 now, I'd kill myself. You know, the same, you know, whatever mile repeats at 5:20s or something. I couldn't even do one of them. But instead of saying, okay, I'm going to adjust it by an age graded scale or doing it, you let your body know. I know what it felt like to do that. The feel is exactly the same. The paces have changed. The volume might have changed. And then the feel for the recovery, I think, is probably even more important. The density of your training is what the experts talk about. But how do you know? Every person's different and everybody ages differently. I mean, and you're different at different times of the year, all of these things.
Right.
and we get into trouble by not knowing our body and then not pay attention to our body and not being willing to adjust. So I've gone on for a while, but let me say one more thing is that I think it's more than just adopting that, but we have to really get away from the idea that the training plan is what matters, but what happens to our body is what matters, to accept that and to realize, you know, hey, we think we're fit because we can look at our Strava feed or our training log. No, we're fit because our body is fit, you know, and whatever it takes to get there, care of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really smart. You know, like as you said, as you become a more experienced runner, you should be able to listen to your body even better and know when to push yourself and when to ease back and not be so married to a strict training schedule, you know, maybe a cookie cutter plan that is not taking into account your particular needs. So yeah, that's makes a lot of sense.
I did find a spectrum of people as far as run by feel based on personality. I think this is important. I mean, those who say, I like to have a structure, I like to have a plan. Dave Dunham, who's a mountain runner there from New England, he's that way. He says, you know, when I go to the speed workout, I want to know what my goal times are and I want to know the structure. The way he gets around that sort of training by feel is he races so often that, you know, a race is by feel, by nature. You're racing as hard as you can. You're going as hard as you can. And then it gives you some data. And then he uses that data to structure his workout. So he's very aware of his body because of how often he races. So that then uses that to codify his training.
So the next key that you talk about is humility and hunger. So tell us what that means.
Very interesting that, you know, talking to these people, Olympians, I mean, Roger Robinson is the guy who ran on two international teams, England and New Zealand. He set master's records at New York City Marathon and Boston. I think he set a master's record at Boston. Anyway, several top marathons in his 40s, 50s, won a world championship. Anyway, first thing he tells me is, I was never that good. I was kind of good.
You're like, what?
Exactly. But everybody, it became almost like I'd wait for it in the interview. Yeah, I'd tell them, how'd you get started? And they talk about being small and unathletic. And then they'd say, I was never that good. I was always the back of the pack. I had a lot of people beating me. But I got better. And that was the theme, that they got better. And this, I think, distinguishes from, again, the people we saw in the beginning that were really good and then fell off, is that they had, and I referenced in here the book called Mindset by Carol Dweck, where she talks about your mentality. Do you have a fixed mentality? Do you have a growth mentality? And so, and a fixed mentality is this idea that you either, you're fast or you're slow, you're talented or you're not talented. And a lot of people who started out thinking they were talented or were talented, you have to just keep defending that. Erasing all of your running is only just a method to prove to yourself that, yeah, you are as good as you think you are. None of the people who continue for a lifetime had that mentality. They had this humble idea that, wow, there are a lot of people better than me, and I can get better. And so, it's probably the most important psychological key here is this idea that growth, being able to get better, is where the joy is, not the absolute success, but the process of getting better.
So it's the journey, not the destination, I guess, and said in other terms.
Yeah, it is. And even though in every destination you arrive at, you celebrate and you're happy about it. I mean, Dean Castor said, one thing that amazed her was that no matter what I accomplished, there was always something more. There was always something more to accomplish. Whereas one of the guys who quit said, you know, I got to the point I didn't have any goals left. It's like, I mean, that in some ways shows a little bit of lack of imagination, or yeah. just that your goals were so defined by time or place,
right.
as opposed to, again, Dina's, that, you know, the real rewards haven't been the accolades, haven't been the medals. It's been the process of becoming the best person you can be. And that best person you can be at 53. I mean, because it's relative to where you are in your life.
Exactly. Good stuff. The next key number five, is adaptability. So tell us what that means.
So, I mean, pretty obvious, you know, adapt or die sort of is the mandate of the world. I ended up breaking this into two chapters, adaptable goals and adaptable training. So again, interviewing people, the way I did the interviews too was I didn't ask people for their keys. I just asked them to describe their running lives. Okay, when did you start? And then just work your way through till now. So what I kept hearing as people were walking through their lives is that, you know, while almost everybody had a goal of setting a PR at 35, I mean, all of us, you know, it's this whole progression of times and or places that they got to a point where they had to find new goals. And there were a wide variety of those. There's different ways to, the key is using like a Csikszentmihalyi's flow theory, is that you need to find a goal that is equal to the skills you're bringing to it. I mean, that's where the joy is when, when you have a high goal and high skill that match. And so people told me a lot of ways they found this, you know, whether it's age grading or something like Boston Qualifier that changes with age, or one of the simple ones is just finding a rival. You have somebody who's similarly matched, and you show up on the weekend and it's like, am I going to be able to beat him today or not? You know, and that's totally adaptable to wherever you are in life, you know, whether you're, you know, 35 or 78. You know, Roger Robinson now has two knee replacements and has a friend, you know, I forget his name, but, you know, Bernie's going to show up and we're going to beat the shit out of each other.
Kind of brings the childlikeness back into, you know, your running. Because when you're a kid, it's all about beating the other, you know, kids.
Yeah. And we kind of forget that, I think, in racing, because we are so tied to times now. You know, Benji Durden would say, you know, while he's in the race, he picks out somebody. The guy in the yellow singlet, I'm going to try to beat him. And that's what racing is about, childlike. So that's one side. And then there's adaptable training. And adaptable training, again, should be easier than it is. What I found, and I heard this in people's language because they describe it, is that the problem is we get so tied to the numbers, there's an emotional attachment to the numbers. It's not just a 7:30 mile. If you're running slower than that, it's disgusting. It's slow. It's
you're not a runner anymore.
Exactly.
Those are horrible words to describe one's running, you know, disgusting.
Yeah, but I understand it and hear that. You know, competitive runners. And I think there was a usefulness to that at some point of saying it's a personal, you know, you're not settling for that. So, you know, at one point, if you ran slower than that, it means you were taking it too easy. And so, oh, that's disgusting. I need to be tougher. I need to work harder. I need to get fitter. But what happens when your former marathon pace is now your 5K pace? You can't look at the clock and say, oh, that's disgusting. How can I run that slow? You have to learn to adapt to it. And so what I heard the people, successful people, is that they found some emotional distance, that they were able to somehow separate themselves from the past. And some of them actually trampled on the past, like threw away their logs. You know, it's like done. That was a different person. I am a new person now. Some of these skills we need to learn that it's today. What can I do now? Which requires a lot of honesty too.
So kind of like pressing reset on your ego and that mental dialogue that you tell yourself about
self-talk.
Your running. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The next thing you talk about is being a student of the sport. And I thought this was really good, because if a person gets stagnant, then they tend to die, or, you know, even fall away from something they're interested in.
Yeah. And student sport, I think, ties in, again, we talked about being a chef. You have to know what the ingredients do. Or another analogy I used in here is the difference between being a student sport is, if you're following a training plan blindly, it's like somebody giving you directions to get across the city. You know, you turn left at the Red Barn and you turn right at the at the fire hall. Well, if you get off the route, you're totally lost. You have no idea where you're going. Whereas being a student, you have a map, so you can find your way around. You know which direction things are going. And similarly, I think one of the interesting things I found is that not only is it, I think, essential in order to continue to adapt and to be a better runner, but it creates more interest too. And you're solving the puzzle of how do I put together the ingredients of this body at this day to have the best results. And so that way, actually, it's a greater challenge for me now at 53 than it was at 35. I'd done several marathons. It's like, okay, I know what works for me. I just have to go do it again and try to do it better.
Right.
Now, I don't know what works for me. It's a new experiment. My body has changed from 20 years ago. It's changed from 1 year ago. It's increasingly different. So the challenge, the puzzle, which is part of the fun, the puzzle becomes even harder in that way.
Did you find that these runners are also staying current on like news in the running world, trends, scientific research, perhaps, some of the new innovations in the sport?
I did. You'd think maybe that somebody who started running in the 1960s would be doing static stretching and some of these things. They're not. They are. And part of this, again, moving ahead to the next one, is that a lot of them are coaches too. And so in that way, they want to keep up with what's happening with other people. And then they're applying that to themselves as well.
Yeah. The next one was staying connected.
Right.
So we're talking about keys to staying hungry and number 7, staying connected.
Everybody I talked to had some other connection besides their own running with the sport. Mm. A lot of them are coaches. Some of them are writers, probably because I know more writers because that's what I do. But or they volunteered at the race, or they were, their local USATF rep, all these different ways that they not only were able to, be in contact with other runners, which I think is huge for your up and down of your running, that you are still in touch and you're seeing runners and you're seeing the passion, and you think, okay, maybe right now I can't do that because I'm healing up a stress fracture in my shin, but I want that again. I'm not just falling away and letting things get in the way. But also getting out of your own head, I think mm-hmm. It just helps to see other people going through some of the struggles. And it's a lot easier to say to somebody else, it's like, that's not a big deal. You didn't run the time you wanted, but it was a hot day and things didn't go well. It's easy to say that to somebody else, and you realize with yourself that you can give yourself that emotional distance too, from some of your goals.
Yeah, I could see it'd be a lot harder to maintain enthusiasm for running if you were in isolation and didn't get together with other running communities, because the running community is so encouraging and positive, and just seeing what other people are doing, even if, like you said, even if you're like rehabbing an injury, but still running is more top of mind, and you're getting encouragement from other runners, getting inspired, and you have like this motivation to get back to running during a downtime.
Yeah, I always find like during a race, it's really inspiring for me to see older people participating. Like, wow, that's so awesome. This white-haired grandma just passed me. I'm like, that gives me so much hope,
Absolutely, yeah. And I think in my experience, that I mentioned this in the acknowledgments, that a family of runners in my hometown, the parents, this was 1977, but the parents had really bought in. And so from the beginning, I saw 50 or 60 year old people who loved it and went to every road race. And it's like, okay, that's what you do. It was normal.
Right.
It's fun to see that. Yeah. And now I coach teenagers. And so I have their enthusiasm every day and seeing their growth. It's like, yeah, this is something I want to be part of.
And you're able to mentor and pass on your years of wisdom too, which, often it's when you have to teach something or you have to mentor somebody that it really makes you, stay even more connected and keep learning, keep growing.
Keeps it fresh.
Yeah.
For sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. The best way to retain knowledge is to have to teach it.
Right.
Yeah. And to pay attention, as editor, it was huge to being a coach. You write a story or you see a story, but then if you have to apply it to the kids the next day, it's like, okay, I really need to know what exactly these faces are and what exactly the parameters are, and again, to have it apply and to have it apply to different people. It's the nuance of it, not just the overall idea.
Definitely. Yeah. Eighth key that you talk about is hope. And I really connected with this one, tapping into the power of optimism. So, what are some of the ways that we can stay hopeful as runners, even though our physical ability is going to decline with age?
Good question. And I think hope, the idea that we could still get better, it depends. We have to redefine better, perhaps, and sometimes. But there's even the feeling of almost always we've never been the best you can be. And training is the question of getting the best that you can. But that the hope idea. I found a point I added after I had started the book. I had done several of the interviews and made an outline, and we only had 8 keys. but as I did more and more interviews, I kept coming across these people who had totally traumatic problems, you know, that they found out they had diabetes, they had a heart valve replacement, they had a stroke, they had a knee replacement, things that you would think, I mean, bigger, much bigger things than a lot of people who stopped, but they still decided that they could become better. They could become a runner again. You know, they could get back, they could do it. And I thought, well, this certain personality type, there's not much to do with that. And I was sitting down for dinner with a former classmate a year ago, again, that trip to Millinocket. And he's a coach, and he's the race director of the local 10 miler, which he won once in like 56 minutes.
Wow.
So now he's my age. He's a year older, 54. And he says, well, I can't run sub 60 now. It's not because I'm 54. It's because I don't train enough. And I realize that that mentality is the same mentality as the person who had a stroke and decided to come back is, I can be better. If I did things differently, I have the hope that I could be better. And this is a shared characteristic of all these people. And so I went, again, as I did in several other things, went to look at the literature. And this guy named Seligman wrote a book called Learned Optimism, which I found really useful. That the idea that every time you're presented with a problem, so you run the race and it's you run 65 minutes and you think you could run 60, the pessimistic side would say, well, I'm too old now. You know, it's permanent. It's pervasive. That's just it. You know, and we see a lot of people. I mean, that's the giving up. I'm too old. It's never going to happen again. Instead, argue with the consequences. Well, why is it? Well, again, today could have been a hot day. I could do differently. I hadn't been doing enough speed work. I haven't doing enough distance. So arguing with it, saying, if I change these things, could I get better? And believing then you can get better. It's a really useful tool. And it was interesting for me to think of optimism as a tool. It's not a personality trait. It's something you can use to, again, to argue with the consequences. Now, at some point, the answer is, yes, I'm too old for 60 minutes. And that's where you get into the adaptability stuff we were talking about. But he, again, I think it was useful to say, then argue with the implications of it. So what? You know, the example I gave in the book is I like to run a sub 130 half in my 50s. And I haven't been able to do it yet, but I keep arguing with the consequences, you know, that I ran at altitude one time, it was too hot one time, it was too cold in Millinocket, it was 9 degrees. And I was taking pictures for a story, you know,
right.
but I ran 135, so, you know, it's close, I still have a possibility. I might not, though. It's possible I may not break 130 again. So, you know, but the pessimistic side says, so, well, it's not even worth, you know, if you can't run a 130 half, why even bother racing? You know, that's the, I ran a 116 once, so you know, 130 is pathetic. Again, using these terms, it's like, okay, wait a second. You know, that's 650 miles. And what's the difference between a 130 and a 132? You know, it's just an arbitrary number. Try to be as fit as I can. Celebrate that I'm still running half marathons and, you know, pretty fast for a 53-year-old. Argue with the consequences of that. That's the hope, again, is the idea that I can do better and I can be a better runner. So right now, you know, set a goal in the future and decide, you know, work towards that.
And even, you know, if you divorce the times or the PR, seeking PRs, I think that hope, it kind of pushes you to become the best version of yourself, whatever age you are, whatever your health or your life situation. I think that's one of the things about being a lifelong runner is that constant drive to be the best version of yourself. And, you know, we never probably reach that, but that hope keeps you going. Running is about becoming the best version of ourselves and elevating our life through running in the many ways that makes our lives better. And it also goes into your last key is love. And it boils down to that's why we run, you know, hopefully. Not that we're going to love every run, but it's that baseline.
Yeah, and you're right, and I'm glad that came through. I the first version of my first draft of the book had just lots more quotes because you just hear that optimism and that hope and that love. You know, I had to cut it down because you just couldn't have that many quotes, both for style and length. But I kept hearing that people had gotten away from the idea of running as a means to an end. It wasn't just a way to, certainly not. I mean, all the things that many people, the health benefits or the social aspects, those are all great. But even not just a means to win races. Running itself was worthwhile in terms of, that was the end. To be able to go out, feel fit, and run. And run for as long as you want. These runners that have gotten to that point, now they still like to race and they like to do well and they like the affirmation of that. But in fact, I'd ask them, do you like to run or do you like to race? And they always, it's like, well, both. And the two, there's a synergy that you put the race out there and that gives you a goal and that gets you out the door and you do more workouts and you do harder workouts. Thing is, you enjoy doing those workouts. You just need the excuse to do it, so that the race helps you train more. Then the training is really the end result. And some of the people had given up racing, but still did the training. And I think maybe that is kind of the ultimate, the zen. But the race has other benefits too. This love of running is where I think we need to get to, and get away from the obligatory aspects of it. I mean, so many runners, even good runners who seem to love it, will complain and mean the complaints. It's like, oh, I've got to do, I got to go to the track today. I got to do speed work. It's like, wow, you're 55 years old and you're going to the track and doing speed workout. How awesome is that? Get that mentality of like, you can still move, you can still fly, you can still do these things. That's worth celebrating every day.
Yeah, I often will look at, just observe people, and there's some who just seem like they're waiting to die. It's like, there's a reason why they can't do this and they can't do that. They're too old for this and they're this and that.
They've limited themselves.
Yeah, they've limited themselves mentally. And I think that's one of the beauties about being a runner. You may not be fast anymore. You may not be able to go as long as you did anymore, but you're not taking aging sitting down. You're just constantly chasing more life, I think. So that's really neat.
and I think it's important then to learn that early. If you can get away from the mentality, even like, if you're a high school cross-country runner, rather than, I've got to go out and do my run today, it's like, learn, you get to run, and you have this ability and you have this chance to be alive in a way that you're very hard in other parts of life to feel as alive as you do when you're out running.
That's right.
Okay, so everyone can make that shift right now in their vocabulary from I have to I get to.
Yeah.
Just replace those words next time you have a scheduled run. And maybe I'll just kind of sum up all the points for the listeners. So these are the 9 keys to staying strong and staying hungry. We talked about consistency, variety, training by feel, humility and hunger, adaptability, being a student of the sport, staying connected, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love.
That's right.
So Jonathan, as you were sitting down to write a book about running, did you find yourself thinking, this is about more than just running? This is also life. These are principles for life in general.
Absolutely. As I was getting towards the end of the book, I kept feeling like, wow, I'm touching on something a lot bigger here. And I know I'm just touching on it. When I talked to you guys earlier that my first book, Your Best Stride, I felt like I really got my hands around it. This is what everybody knows right now. This book, the topic is so big. It's about life that I was just touching on the edges of what it really means, and understanding it is going to take a lifetime for myself. But it's been huge for me. And how I've seen, I think before I started this book, I still wouldn't have been sure I would be running, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. Hmm. I feel now that there's a good chance of it, that I'll be running and racing and enjoying it. Well, my last chapter, the very end, is why run for life, which isn't one of the keys. Mm-hmm. But again, talking about using running to learn this perspective, I think is really at the end of saying that it's worthwhile to be the best person you can be, as you said, Molly. And I was working early morning one day before heading off to my son's basketball game, and sort of that became a revelation of this is just why we're doing this. that it's way beyond race results. It's way beyond health. It's gaining the perspective that here and now is what you have, and we want to be as alive as possible. Hmm. And I had my running clothes on and I just headed out and started running. I felt like the Navajos greeting the sun. I started running towards the sunset, sunrise. I'm sorry. It was sunrise.
Nice.
With my 3 dogs and came back and said, yeah, this is why I'm writing this book.
Yes.
This is what, and I need to learn it, and I'm applying it a lot more in terms of just just the joy of running and running by feel. But anytime I get a chance to run, go run. It doesn't have to be a schedule. You know, it could be 2 miles. It's worth it. Just get out there and do it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd really encourage everyone who wants to be a lifelong runner to get their hands in this book. And
that's right.
It was very helpful for me as I will be turning 40 next year and becoming a master's runner. It really gave me just a great perspective of what to expect, what to implement, and you know how to keep a proper mindset so that I can be strong and healthy.
But no matter what age you're at, if you want to be a lifelong runner and stay strong and stay hungry, definitely go out and find a copy of this book. I'm sure it's on Amazon and everywhere else. Jonathan, any links that you want to share with folks?
Well, my website is jonathanbeverly.com, and I have links to the books there and then to just a lot of my writing over the last 20 years.
Awesome. It could take a lifetime just to read everything you've
written.
Contributed.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good use of your life. You should just choose sparingly and then go run.
Oh, it's part of being a student of the sport. So,
well, thanks for talking to us again and keep up the good work. It's been fun.
Thank you for hosting me. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jonathan Beverly. We'll have links on our website if you want to find him and check out more. We definitely recommend the book Run Strong, Stay Hungry. And appreciate Jonathan taking time to walk us through the chapters. A lot of authors don't want to do that. You know, they don't want to like spoil it. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. Angie's going to answer a question that we received about being a slower runner and sort of how to deal with that. Before we get into that, we'd love to thank our episode sponsor, Sunbasket. This is the time of year, you know, when everyone's thinking about eating healthy. So if you've made a resolution to eat healthier in 2018, Sunbasket makes it easier than ever.
That's right. You can get $35 off your first order when you go to sunbasket.com/marathon. Like Trevor said, you know, if your goal is to cook more at home, to eat out less, to eat healthier, you can have healthy meals regularly delivered to your door with Sunbasket, and it really makes it easy to stay on track. And the ingredients that they have in their boxes are organic produce, responsibly raised meats, sustainably sourced fish, organic pasture-raised eggs, and organic non-GMO tofu. And it's all personalized. You can mix and match from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, and more. They've got a ton of variety with 18 recipes to choose from each week. And best of all, each delicious, easy recipe is ready in about 30 minutes.
So with Sunbasket, you have total flexibility. You can cancel anytime, skip anytime, and choose any meal plan you want. Just go to sunbasket.com/marathon to learn more and get $35 off your first order. At sunbasket.com/marathon. Okay, let's get into the quick tip. Angie, this is an important one. We actually have talked about issues faced by slower runners in the past. You know, we had a whole podcast episode about that. So it's probably time to revisit this topic, I think. So here's a question that we received from a runner who describes herself as a slow runner.
That's right. This comes from Maya, and she says, I've been training for a marathon for the past couple of months, and I have to be honest with you, I'm a slow runner. Running has never been easy for me. I'm really short and not built like a runner, but I set a goal all those months ago, and I'd like to accomplish it. I've been training off and on, and the marathon that I signed up for is coming soon. I'm aiming for about a 15-minute per mile pace average. I just don't want to be laughed at or judged for how slow I'm going to be running. That's why my training has been all over the place. I keep convincing myself I shouldn't even run a marathon. I don't know, I guess I'm kind of freaking out that come race day, by the time I finish, everyone will be gone, and then when people ask me my time and I say about 6 hours, they'll judge me. I guess I'm looking for some encouragement and some advice on how to deal with this.
Wow, that is a great question. Thank you, Maya. And I could definitely see how that would be a, you know, a huge concern for a lot of people. Angie, I'll let you tackle this, but first thing that comes to my mind is I doubt that she would be the last person to finish no matter what marathon she's at. And there's always going to be lots of folks who are, you know, run walking and who are back of the packers, and just there's no shame in that at all.
That's right. And, you know, like we pointed out, we've done an episode on slower runners before. It was very popular. And a lot of people are proudly slower runners, but it is normal that some people are self-conscious about their pace.
Yeah.
Some runners feel like they're not quote unquote real runners if they run slow, which of course you and I think is totally untrue. The truth is that most people wish they were faster, whether you're a 6 hour marathoner or a 3 hour marathoner. I mean, I've met very few people who are totally happy with the pace that they run at. You know, there's always that warring desire to improve in some way. And unfortunately, there are judgmental people out there who don't understand slower marathon times.
both inside and outside the running community.
I would say there are just a handful of people, though. But unfortunately, when those people complain, those are the things that you remember, not all the people that give you a thumbs up and a great job, you know?
Right. And so I think you really have to just decide that you're not going to worry about people who don't understand or don't approve. I've had non-runners ask me before if I won the marathon that I did. And when I answer no, they seem disappointed in me. So, you know, there's always going to be someone who doesn't understand, no matter how fast or slow you run. So I think the key to having peace with your marathon time is to decide that you're going to do this marathon for yourself on your own terms. That way, if someone doesn't understand, it's not going to bother you as much because you're not doing it for them. You know, you're doing it for yourself. For some reason, people like to chime in with their opinions, and social media makes that super easy. You know, we can comment on strangers' lives in just the typing of a few keys.
And sometimes we do it anonymously.
Exactly. But I think, Maya, if you really define your why for taking on this challenge, then it becomes about your personal journey and about becoming a better version of yourself. So whatever your pace is, training for that marathon becomes a life-changing experience. And we've also recommended that if a person thinks that they're a slower runner, that they choose a marathon with a generous cutoff time to decrease your anxiety about your finishing time. You know, if you feel like you're a slower runner, don't choose a marathon with a 5-hour cutoff time. That's just going to bring undue stress and pressure to you and increase the chance that you're going to be left out on the course without support. But there are lots of marathons that have longer cutoff times, and I think there's a lot of marathons who really want to work with each runner and make their experience really good. So we do have a couple articles on our website that may be helpful to people who are wanting to take on the adventure of marathon training as a slower runner. So, you know, head over to our website and check those out. We'll include links in the show notes. But we just want to encourage people that it's not about your pace. It's about your own personal experience and becoming a stronger, healthier, and better version of yourself.
Yeah, it's all about going the distance and whatever level that you're at right now, whatever ability you have, pushing yourself and doing the best that you can do. And who cares about how fast or how slow you're going? You know, you just are trying to become a better version of yourself. You're not trying to compare yourself to others. And if you can cross the finish line and go 26.2 miles, you are a badass, no matter how long it took you.
That's right. And we've actually heard from people who have finished last in marathons before.
It's called a DFL.
Yes.
We won't explain what that
is. Dead freaking last. So, but their perspective was that, you know, they beat everyone who didn't show up for the race or who
there
didn't even bother to finish their training or who is still back home on the couch. So even if there's that slim chance that you do finish last, you still have the bragging rights of finishing, completing your goal, and being proud of yourself.
All right. Well, so thank you so much for the question, Maya. Hope that was helpful. That's it for this episode. Thanks, guys, for being listeners and fans of the MTA podcast. Excited about what this year holds. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or Google Play or wherever you find your podcast. That way you'll be notified when a new show comes up. And guess what? With the new iOS, if you're an Apple user, it's easier than ever to share the podcast. If you have a running friend who you think would enjoy the show. We're really excited about the upcoming guests that we have and upcoming shows and races we're going to do this year and just all the unexpected things that are going to come up that you never know in a year what a year can bring forth. So looking for great things here in 2018. And we're here to help you guys any way we can. We have a contact form on our website if you want to send in a question. It's pretty easy to do. And either Angie or I will get back to you. And of course, we'd love to help you get to the next level. If you want to go deeper in your training, you can learn about Academy membership when you visit our website. Until next time, folks, keep taking action toward your goals. And remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Run on my way, run on my way. Well, on my way. Hey, hey, hey. Now, now.